We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now, that's what I call science. You are listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show and podcast brought to you from Hobart, Tasmania. If you're a regular listener, you'd know that each week we unpack a different STEM topic. So that's science, technology, engineering and maths. And for the last 2 weeks, we've been doing a bushfire special. But I'm really excited to say that we're talking with some expert engineers about the types of challenges or exciting opportunities climate change and bushfires pose from an engineering perspective. My name's Neve Chapman. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Sarah Lydon. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
We're joined in studio with Samantha Vahidi. So you're the works coordinator for strategy and fire production services at Hydro Tasmania.
My background is a civil engineer. So to be in fire, that's quite multidisciplinary. So it's quite interesting because I have to work with lots of different types of engineers. So electrical, mechanical, in hydros particularly. But yes, so no, my job is really looking at more of our capital fire programs, so how we manage fire within our power stations. But I work very closely with our vegetation program in Arena, who looks after a lot of the prep work that we need to do prior to a bushfire coming in or the season. So it's really exciting. And then with the strategy particularly, we look at, I guess, long-term planning. So it's a very fun role that I have.
And our other guest for today is Jason King, who is Head of Network Operations at TAS Networks. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks. Glad to be here. Exciting topic. So
it is. And do you deal much with fire or bushfire risk in your role, similar to Sam, or are you kind of a little bit broader.
So as operations manager, I've got the control room, so we have to actually operate the network, and we also deal with the running the emergency. So how do we respond when there is a bushfire and an impact on the network? So we do really rely on a lot of our other engineering teams with their strategies and the assets out there. If they do a good job, then it's a lot easier to operate the network and keep the lights on. When they don't, then the networks become very vulnerable to things like bushfires and weather events. So I normally get on their back soon after we have an event if it doesn't quite go the way we hope.
Can I ask what you mean by the network?
Yes, a good question. So in Tasmania, what we call the power network or the power grid pretty much comprises of, we have 220,000 volt power lines. So they're the pylons that you see run up and down the country. So they feed power in and out to the mainland as well through the Basslink cable and basically feed the regions of Tasmania. And they take the power from hydro, from their hydro stations, and they transmit it around the state. And then we go down to 22,000 and 11,000 volt lines. And they're typically the ones that are impacted a little bit more by fires. And they go around the suburbs. And then they have the boxes that you see on the poles and on the ground that change the 22,000 and 11,000 volts down to 400 and 230 volts. And those are the lines that go into people's houses that they get their electricity from.
So when talking about the network versus the source, we could kind of think of Sam working for Hydro as some of the source, where some of the power is coming from, and then you're more the network in terms of how it gets spread out and distributed to our households across the state.
Yeah, and another good way to think about it is there's generation, so there's a source, then there's transmission, that's how you transmit the power, and then there's distribution, which goes down another level, and then you've got the retailers that actually bill you for your power. So those are the key players.
Good way to put it in perspective. What we're here to talk about today is bushfires and their impacts on engineering infrastructure. So Sarah, do you have any burning questions you want to start us off with?
I guess just to start with, thinking about what are the main kinds of infrastructure that can be impacted by bushfires? From a hydro point of view, pretty much everything can be affected by bushfire, which is why it's a very big risk for hydro, as with TAS Networks. So if you think about all the way from the very start of how we produce power, that would be our water and our reservoirs. So obviously a bushfire can impact on the wildlife, which I think you heard last week a lot about, all the way through the water system. So, you know, how we convey our water, which could often is through pipelines, canals, flumes. And then we get down to the actual power station itself, which is where one of my roles come in and looking at, okay, well, that building can be impacted by the bushfire itself. If a bushfire then would enter into the power station, then the equipment inside could be made vulnerable.
But I guess I would probably throw to Jason now when you think about, okay, well, how do we transmit? So we've made the power from hydro, but we're about to actually leave the power station now through our network, and that again can be impacted by fire.
Yeah, it's a good point. So from a TAS network's point of view, so after it leaves hydro, we have our transmission towers that we talked about. So what we're concerned with there is the security of supply for Tasmania. So if one of our transmission circuits get impacted by bushfires, it can cut off the ability for hydro to generate power and actually get it to the different parts of the state. And one concept is the fact you've always got to match the generation with the demand, and that's one of the key concepts of electricity, if you like, and supply of electricity. So if parts of the hydro network and dams get isolated from the power grid because one of our transmission line goes down, then that can impact the generation capacity. And if our demand in Tasmania is higher than that, then we have a shortfall. And so that's what we call about the security of the supply. So the grid is always trying to balance those two things. And if the security of supply goes down, that generally impacts large parts of Tasmania. So that's the first key thing. Our other issue is we've got about 222,000 poles out there. So when you get down to the distribution level we talked about, which is more the 22,000, the 11,000 volt poles, a lot of those are wooden. So it doesn't take much. An ember attack will take out a wooden pole quite quickly. They burn, if we term them a little bit like a matchstick, they burn a little too easy. So they're very susceptible. So some people may remember the Denali bushfires in 2013 where we had around 600 poles impacted. They were distribution poles. They're all wooden and they take a long time to get back up. So they really start affecting the communities where those wooden poles supply the distribution network. So we've got that transmission, which is security, and then we've got the distribution, which really is the supply to people's houses, and that can take a long time to put back up. So there's always that tension between the let's call it the life the economic life of the assets that you're putting in that affects the cost to customers, and then there's the technology that's coming in, and that's intersection between do you use wood, do you use concrete, but there's some really good technologies coming out now with fiberglass and concrete poles, so and also fire retardant paint that you can put on poles, because with these 222,000 poles that we've got, if we were just going to go out there and say we'll put some new, we'll change more to concrete, that's a huge cost. So you've got to deal with technology that sometimes, and some of these assets have a 40 to 50 to 70 year lifespan. So you've got to deal with assets that have been in the network for quite a long time. And as climate changes and those sorts of things, that may come under attack. And then you've got to look at some of the new technology where we can start putting into those areas where we are starting to change assets when they're older, and how can we make the network more resilient, but also keep the cost down to customers.
I wonder if you can talk about how significant the effects could be for communities with some of the damage to infrastructure that we've just talked about.
I think the biggest risk is really just depending on what type of infrastructure has been damaged. So if we were unfortunate to lose a supply, like Jason mentioned, that could take months or, potentially a year to replace, depending on it. But obviously, as utilities, we know that as a risk, and so we do try our very best to make sure we have good contingencies in place. So that would be talking about, or how would we rebuild assets that have been burned. So in hydro, one of our, I guess, key risks would be our penstocks and pipelines. So we have timber penstocks and pipelines around the state, so having factoring sprinkler systems around some of our assets, but we can also just have an idea of what would that risk be, where would we source different supplies if we needed to, and things like that.
Yeah, we do a lot of preparedness as well. So a lot of our planning is continuous. We spend around $30 million a year. So vegetation is huge for we talked about the power network with power lines, because vegetation can cause fires. And then we need to make sure. So one, sort of our key strategies are, one, we don't want our assets to start fires, and there is a risk that they can. And B, we want them to be resilient when there is fires. So we do a lot of work with hydro. We call a summer readiness preparation, and even considering all our planned work. So what we don't want to be doing is having some very important power lines and transmission lines out of service when we come into the bushfire season. And then that as there's less options for hydro than to generate on the network, and that can cause security issues. So we're looking at the impact on planning. There's also a wider issue now as well with the impacts on the mainland that we've seen with the bushfires, that they very much through summer rely on Tasmania to export generation across Basslink to support Victoria, which does have a lot of risks as far as with the coal now retiring. They're very much reliant, they haven't so much been in the past, on that Basslink cable, and hence the generation in Tasmania and our lines to be able to transport those across to support the mainland as well. So there's a lot of things to consider, I suppose.
You're listening to That's What I Call Science on Edge Radio or on demand via your favourite podcast streaming service. You are listening to That's What I Call Science, and we're talking about bushfire risk. You've touched on the fact that there's increased, or that there's some planning that goes around the increased risk of fire during the summer. But what role does climate change play in that planning, and how soon do you have to do that? Does your planning have to change, and how do you have to adapt to that in terms of hazard reduction?
Yes, that's a really good question, Neve. So I guess what we've been doing over the last 5 to 10 years in hydro has been we've been looking at specific engineering zones around our assets to make sure that if a bushfire did come in through, they would be protected. And that has a lot to do with the type of fire that I think you've heard about before in terms of its intensity, the soil type, the vegetation, all of that will affect the fire as it comes through in the front. So those zones have kind of been set, but as climate change occurs, the question now that's being posed by TasFire, the Parks and Wildlife and the utilities is, you know, are those zones adequate now? Because fires are showing that they actually can be much more intense. Ignitions can happen much faster and they can spread much quicker. So I guess what we view is that, you know, it's like any aspect, we just need to continually improve. And so I guess Hydro is working very closely with Parks and Wildlife, TAS Networks and TasFire to think about what's the next step that we want to take. So what we've really been thinking about is really just, what's the next step that we can improve, whether it's just thinking about fire differently. I think you've heard previously in other podcasts about green belts. That's something Hydro's been thinking about in the future, just ways that we can manage it differently. But also in terms of evacuation plans, which I guess, Jason, if in your role in TasNet, you might be able to speak more to.
Yeah, so for TAS Networks, we look at, because we've got the whole of the state and obviously our lines are everywhere, into the extremity. So we focus a lot on what we call the bushfire consequence areas, which generally is around the east coast. So we know from a lot of the modelling that the Bureau does and working closely with TasFire that we really drill right down into the areas that are most at risk. And so we focus a lot of our attention on those areas. One, looking at any defects on the network that we might think, look, on a hot, windy day, are those lines getting a bit older, likely to clash and cause a fire? Should we renew them now? So there's a sort of a risk matrix that goes into that to try and replace assets that are at high risk, determine which areas are the highest risk areas. But you made a really good point around we're starting to see with climate change where we focus on the East Coast. It was only in 2016 where we had the Tarkine area, which shouldn't burn. And a lot of that vegetation hasn't burned for hundreds of years. And all of a sudden we've got bushfires. So we're always conscious of the fact that, you know, a fire can start outside of bushfire season and the season's getting longer. And we do look very closely at some of the climate modelling, and what it's telling us there's a, you know, we often feel there's a gradual change with climate change, and we hear that the temperature, from what I've heard, has increased a few degrees over the last 100 years. But what it's also starting to show is the intensity when these events happen. They seem to be a lot more intense. We had flooding in the 2016. We seem to get a lot more lightning storms that come through with a lot of this these weather events as well. So when you get a hot day in Tassie, you get that prevailing one that comes after it. There's often a thunderstorm, and so we are seeing fires pop up in areas that we haven't seen before. So we've got to take all that into account with our modelling, because we've all got a limited amount of money and resources. So where do you focus your best attention to try and reduce the risk and keep the price down? So all those things are always sort of bubbling up in the engineers' minds as to, you know, where do we focus our attention to make sure that we can do the right thing.
So we've talked about how bushfires can kind of impact on engineering infrastructure, but we also want to think about, is there kind of the reverse effect? Can power grids, for instance, cause bushfires to occur?
It's something we're very conscious of. So I talked earlier around, you know, some of the assets we have out there have been out there for quite a few years. And to give you an example of a program that we're doing at the moment, we're spending around $10 million. So we actually have fuses on the network, if you like, and fuses are similar to fuses on your switchboard. If you remember the old days, there was a bit of wire. You might remember mum and dad threading the wire through when you plugged in your hairdryer and blew the circuit. Believe it or not, some of those power lines are protected by a similar type of device that has a metal wire through it, basically. And the concept is if there's a fault beyond that line, then that little piece of wire burns up and melts, if you like, and the risk is that that can be ejected from that fuse, fall on the ground, and it can cause a fire start. So there's some new technology out now that basically is, let's call it more electronic, more digital, so it actually it reduces the risk by not having that little molten bit of metal fly out the end of that fuse, which was great technology at the time, and these things are everywhere, but again, they do have that risk. We haven't got too many stats, but so to give you an idea, I did a bit of research. I think over Australia, around 4% of fire starts are caused by electricity lines, and they're just operating the way they should. So we're replacing the things like these fuses with other types of sealed fuses that actually control that arc or explosion when there's a fault on that line, and contain them with inside that fuse to make sure that nothing's ejected on the ground that could cause a fire. So that's one example. Because some of our fires, you may get a bird or something across the top of one of our poles that can also cause sparks and set fire to the pole, and that can also be a risk to a fire. So we're trialling what's called these new Titan poles, which are a combination of concrete and fiberglass. For some of our sort of high cost poles and high risk areas. So that's an example of some more technology that we're implementing, again, to try and ensure that we, one, the network's resilient to fires, but B, that we don't start fires. We also, when there's a fire ban day, we actually change the way our network operates. So if you're in the rural areas, when there's what we call transient faults, now these are faults that sort of a branch may hit the line, trip the power out, and then the branch falls to the ground and the line's actually fine to be re-energised. So we have automatic equipment in the field that automatically will re-energise those lines up to four times in the rural areas. When there is a fire ban day, we actually turn that off. So the impact to communities is that they can often experience longer power outages because we have to go and patrol on foot, basically, those lines that could be 40, 50 kilometres long to make sure that they're safe before we turn the power back on. Because the last thing we want to do is again, by that line re-energising itself all the time, we just want to make sure that we reduce the risk on days where the risk is really high. We try and do a lot of work of getting those messages out there through, and there's a lot more channels to get those messages out there now through Facebook, through Twitter, and through media campaigns. So we try and do a lot of that as well because I think bushfires are really a community thing that we all have to be, have a role to play within that. Really interesting thing is when we talk about power, something that's coming that's very important now as well for Hydro as well as TAS Networks is the telecommunications infrastructure that actually controls a lot of our the special, what we call our protection schemes along those lines, and it's a lot of the communication between the power stations and with Hydro. So if those get impacted as well, then those power stations and lines can't operate to the same level that they could ordinarily operate at, and it's quite often those secondary auxiliary systems that we talk about that also need, we need to ensure that they're resilient as well, and they can have more of an impact now, especially with NBN and Telstra services and mobile services for emergency services all run through a repeater that's powered by something. So
that's very true, yeah. That's been one of the things that's definitely been hotly debated, is people being out of communications and telecommunications being down even before power, or how they get rebooted after a power outage.
I guess all I can say with that, Niamh, is that with a lot of the utilities, TAS Networks, Hydro, TAS Fire, is that we know that need to communicate really well, as what Jason said. So we practice it. So that's something that we do on a regular basis, Hydro, along with TAS Emergency Services, TAS Networks. We actually do practice where we have a look at the scenarios where we would actually check how that would operate. And so that's a really good way that we can just make sure that when there isn't an emergency, just testing how those emergency services and what protocols actually go.
So what are some of the key areas in fire management for power systems, and how have recent advances in technology improved fire management?
Yeah, so Sarah, so I guess we've been trying to utilise new technologies within our power stations to optimise reduction in fire risks. So a recent power station, we've just installed what's called a Vortex system, which looks at, instead of where we would usually disperse a water-based sprinkler system, we are using a foam system. And the advantage of this new technology is that we can actually discharge on a live system if needed. Whereas if we accidentally discharged on a live system with the water, we would actually damage, you know, the electrical systems, and that power unit could be out for weeks, or if not months. Whereas the foam system means that, you know, if it was a false discharge for some reason, that unit is still able to be operated straight away. So that's a really good example where more of a material engineering or chemical-based engineering technology has really helped in a practical way to ensure energy supply.
The other thing that's really been advancing as well is some of the data coming through the Bureau of Meteorology. And we actually have a partnership now with UTAS to try and they can now go back into the past with some of this data analytics and actually map what happened in the past to see how accurate this data is and then project it forward. And so when I talked about the bushfire consequence areas, so we can get down to very small parts now, areas, if you like, to actually understand what that what the soil dryness is going to be, what the potential impact in summer is going to be. So the data is really good, and that allows us to channel, I suppose, where we focus on changing a lot of our assets. And then and we're looking at technology all the time. So across the world in the mainland, a lot of utilities, we all look at what we're all doing, and someone may come up with a good idea. We've got some fire-retardant paint that we're trialling on the wooden poles. We've got the new types of concrete and fiberglass poles, which is very new. Traditionally, there were wooden and concrete poles. The beauty about this combination of concrete and fiberglass is it's fire-resistant, and it's light, and it's you know, reasonably economic as well to use in certain situations. So those sorts of things went around in the past. They make a huge difference. Cameras in our substation, so if we can actually see what's going on, similar to hydro as well, for some of our key assets, we can actually respond quicker as well. So all those things, and the fire retardant systems that we're using in our substation. So all those things, technology is sort of changing all the time. So there's lots of cool stuff that's starting to come out. And
yeah, definitely. I think it's a really good point you make. It's taken a long time to get data about how fires behave or how we need to respond, and also how rapidly our climate's changing and how that increases our bushfire risk. In just a moment, we'll be getting a little bit further into the future directions that we could really use as an opportunity to increase engineering infrastructure to adapt to a changing climate. You're listening to That's What I Call Science. We're talking about bushfire risk and climate change. My name's Neve Chapman. I'm joined in the studio with my co-host, Dr. Sarah Lydon. Are you loving life talking about engineering and bushfire risk and maybe dispelling some myths about how behind the scenes engineers are working really, really hard to ensure that we're adaptable in the face of climate change and bushfire risk?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to sort of look at how something that maybe people don't necessarily associate with bushfires is, you know, very much related to that area and all the work that's occurring.
Yeah, I think I definitely hadn't considered the role that engineers play continually in planning and adapting and considering the risks in fire management. I'm joined with two engineering experts from Hydro Tasmania and Tas Networks, and we've been touching on throughout the show a little bit of what are the future directions and how are we going to really engineer the future to be resilient in the face of an ever-adapting climate. I wonder if there's any really exciting advances that you think are on the horizon or pressing issues that we need to consider from an engineering perspective.
I think, yeah, as Jason has previously touched on, I think the types of materials and how we use materials will be a big way into the future. So in terms of making sure that our infrastructure isn't as flammable as it used to be, and also understanding how bushfires spread, so that if we know bushfires can spread quickly, then our response times need to change to factor that in. I guess looking at different ways of managing the fire if they occur, so what types of materials and substances we use again. So previously we've used water typically, but are there other products, so foam products that are better? So in terms of do we need to have cannons, you know, shooting up foam from the top of the power stations is one suggestion, or they all have their own cost factor, which I know we've talked about previously. So it's that weighing those up for cost versus the benefit of them. But I guess, yeah, just knowing that the engineers know that it's a pressing issue and are continually working out ways that we can plan better.
Some of the technologies that are coming out now, and Hydro, I know, are utilising them on King Island, that sort of thing, is where you have some of these remote communities. I suppose the questions engineers ask from a cost point of view, and now bushfires are coming into that narrative as well, as, you know, do you build a a 30-kilometre power line to a community, or could you put a standalone power system in there? So with a combination of solar panels and batteries and the advances in technology of how you use those things, how you store power, there are a lot of systems out there now that you could do that remotely, and that may be a better outcome for a community. They have done a lot of that in the mainland, I think in South Australia and Western Australia, where you've got very long lines, small communities at the end. The traditional way of just supplying those communities with power lines, is that still the way to go of the future? And a lot of those communities are making choices to have these standalone power systems, they call. So that's one area that's now becoming quite economic, and we're seeing some of those pop up. Not so much in Tasmania. We've got a couple of the little ones around that we were trialling. We've done some trials in Bruny Island as well. So rather than building more power lines, with the solar panels, there's a lot of this digital technology out now. We can actually call upon customers to actually export their solar through their batteries, and that actually offsets building another power station or building another power line to supply them. So especially in places like Bruny Island, where we get a peak through the holiday periods. And this is one of the unique things about power networks is, you may have heard, they're all actually built to make sure the power doesn't go off for the peak periods. Now in Tasmania, that's in winter, and that peak period can often be for a week. So all our infrastructure has really got to be there to ensure we can deliver enough power for a week of the year. And just because as a society, especially in the Western world, there are other parts of the world that have rolling blackouts. So that's another way to do it. Rather than build more power lines, you just turn the power off when it's too hot. So there are these other options out there. So, you know, it's testing. Do we have to just build the same old lines and things, or are these other technologies, are there ways of utilising them, and customers coming into that mix as well? So traditionally, like with hydro, it's been sort of one direction. We source power from a generator, and then the consumer at the other end consumes that power. It's starting to turn on its head now with, and there's lots out there where the consumer is now becoming the one that actually generates a fair bit of the power. So how can we utilise that? And our networks, we have to start thinking about, it's all built for the other way around. So we have to start considering this, because this is now going to put pressure on our networks, on our power lines, where customers are actually generating a fair bit of power, and we have to support that. But how can we use it in the power grid for the better of everybody?
It is interesting, because as the technology has advanced and developed, it's become more readily available, which has decreased the costs associated with it. So it is posing some of those more interesting questions. And I think particularly for bushfire recovery, it could be an interesting avenue, because obviously you've got to make that call of what can you do for that community to best service its needs for the future. But then also you've got that recovery period where you don't want to leave them without power, and what's the best way to do short-term generation. And I suppose engineering probably plays a big role in that. I wonder if there are any potential challenges that you see particularly for your role in the current climate of, you know, having to be adaptable and dealing with longer bushfire seasons. Is there key challenges that you're facing?
So one of the big key challenges we have with the increased bushfire season is the reduction in the ability to pre-burn. So in one of our key areas for, I guess, bushfire preparedness is actually to do, I guess, those control burns. But they become much more harder to coordinate. So obviously there's a lot more need to be able to connect with Tasfire, Parks and Wildlife. So I think there will be a need to increase collaboration with also Stedlake land stakeholders, other utilities, just whilst we have less opportunity to do control burns. And the way that we manage, I think we'll need a lot more collaboration through everyone. So moving forward.
Yeah, I think Sam covered that really well. So yeah, there's this you know, with the longer bushfire season, with the impacts we have, you know, it sort of compresses that time frame to do a lot of our important work on the network. And, you know, just like fire burns can only be done with certain weather conditions, a lot of the work that we do on the network has to be very well coordinated between, you know, TAS Networks, Hydro, to make sure that, because every time we do some work, we're taking a component of the power network out so we can work on it. And that has risks on its own, that, you know, there's less other options to transport that power. So we need to make sure that we're doing those, and the ability to do that now because of the longer fire periods is actually, you know, it's getting more challenging because it's more compressed. So coordination is huge, you know, with the fire service, with Hydro and all the other stakeholders. So we need to get more efficient at doing this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So hopefully with some of that exciting technology coupled with some of those challenges that you seem to be really cognizant of, you know, there's a future here that's one of opportunity to kind of overcome and really develop things from an engineering perspective that really underpins how we coordinate and respond to things, doesn't it? So thank you all for joining me in the studio. So thank you to Sam
Fahidi.
Sam Fahidi from Hydro Tasmania, Dr. Sarah Lydon from the University of Tasmania, who's my co-host, and to Jason King from TAS Networks. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name's Neve Chapman. You've been listening to That's What I Call Science. Get in touch with us if you have any questions, and we can try and pose them to some of our experts. And, you know, like, share, and get amongst all the social media stuff, because we're really trying to encourage that at the moment so we can share the good word of science, engineering, technology, and maths with the world.